Welcome to Virtual Economy, a podcast about the business of games for the rest of us. We're your hosts. I'm Michael Footer.
And I'm Amanda Farrow.
On each episode, we'll cover the biggest business beats and bring in expert commentary from lawyers, analysts, and industry pros. This is episode 89. E3 is a state of mind.
What a state of mind it has been. I'm not sure what kind of state of mind it's been, but it's certainly been a thing that's happened.
I mean, this was the slightly watered down version of the episode title, because I didn't want to give away. Like, it would be like skipping to the end of the book.
Yeah. And wait, we're a book, you know what? Now? That's pretty fun.
It's all right. It's all right. We're everywhere. We are transmedia, folks.
Transmedia everywhere. Is the future.
So this is our VE3 or V3 wrap-up. So Virtual Economy 3, Virtual Economy, depending on how you want to look at it. So we are going to be talking about everything that happened the past week, kind of condensing everything into some trends. I am going to spoil it and say the trends that we were looking for pretty much played out the way we expected they were going to. So that's good for us and for you. But there's a lot more nuance in there that popped out through the week. So Amanda, where should we start?
I feel like we should start at the beginning, Mike, which is the very best place to start.
Mm-hmm.
And so the beginning of the Summer Game Mess, Jeff Grubb's Summer Game Mess, Virtual Economy's Summer Game Mess, is to start with the Playdate. Like,
Playdate. Oh,
I feel like we should start with the Playdate. And then we're like, because, you know, it was the beginning. It kind of kicked everything off. Sony went ages before E3 started, so it doesn't really matter. We've already covered it, so we're not going to cover it again. But let's talk about the Playdate. That was a really interesting bookend for the beginning of this season.
It was a great way to start things off. Obviously, we knew the Playdate from Panic was a thing. Things got slowed down during the pandemic. We've talked about that before. And certainly, we saw some of that trickle through the other presentations, as we will talk about. The Playdate, because of the extra time, though, they had more developers that they were able to bring in. So that season one is going to be even more games. I think it's, 24 games now, and two are going to drop a week?
Yeah, that's going to be amazing. They don't just have that, though. They don't just have all of these incredible games. They also have an incredible game design platform that they are going to be releasing as well, so that anyone can make games for the Playdate, which is honestly how it should be. I showed it to our son, who is a burgeoning game developer, and he was really excited. So I'm excited to see what he makes for the Playdate. Mike, what else did Playdate do?
Well, for those of you who are not familiar with the Playdate, I think we need to explain what it is. It's this little tablet size thing. It's about this big, right? It's yellow. It has a couple of buttons on it. It's got a D-pad. But more interestingly, it has a crank so that developers can build this crank thing into their games, which means that you're going to be able to play games on the Playdate that really wouldn't play anywhere else without a peripheral.
Yeah, absolutely. We've already seen some really interesting mechanics that are being utilized as a result of having this little crank as an additional input mechanism. So I'm excited for what kinds of doors that's going to open for very creative indie developers that are interested in pushing the boundaries of what storytelling and gameplay could look like on handheld.
Didn't even Lucas Pope announce a new game?
Oh, sure did.
Yeah, that's pretty
great. Yeah,
love that.
It's about monsters.
But wait. There's more, because they have this awesome dock.
They do have this awesome dock. It looks like this little portable television, and it's also a Bluetooth speaker, but also it has a pen holder, but also there's a pen.
There's a pen. You don't just, what are you going to put in your pen holder if they don't give you a pen?
I mean, I do have an abundance of pens, as you might see.
So the Playdate pre-orders go live next month in July. It'll be $179. They have not announced what the pricing is for the dock, which they say it is a fantastic Bluetooth speaker. Everybody could always use a neat Bluetooth speaker. It's a beautiful yellow, bright yellow. The games are going to be unique.
They look delightful.
And it's clear that they have plans to deliver additional seasons of games. And it's just really great. If you've ever seen one of those old school portable TVs that has the little kickstand on the bottom, it looks exactly like that. The reason why I wanted to start here, though, is because I think it kicked off this theme that we saw run through the entire week, and something that you wouldn't normally see during a physical E3. In fact, a lot of indie developers have said that physical E3 is almost impenetrable for them unless they have a bigger publisher that even then they might not get into South Hall or West Hall. They might be in the concourse, which is this little back area of meeting rooms, which doesn't mean you're not at E3. You're certainly still in the building. But if you're just an independent developer and self-publishing, being at E3 probably
very
means
difficult.
Yeah, you're either in a hotel room or you're lucky enough to get accepted into the mix and have a chance to get people in front of your games. It has not typically been an indie-friendly event, but this week, and still this wasn't E3, and we'll talk about that a little bit more, but this week of summer games, which is pinned around the time that E3 usually happens, has been very good for indies.
Absolutely, and I think that this was a really good bookend for us to be able to frame that conversation, because the Playdate is all about indie development. And it's all about bringing new voices in, established voices in, and trying new and weird kinds of game mechanics because they can.
Mm-hmm.
And why
Absolutely.
Not?
So one of the big stories around not E3 last year was the parting of ways between the Entertainment Software Association, which is an American lobbying group, which exists to lobby the United States government on behalf of the largest players in the game industry. It's paying members
in the United States.
In the United States. And Jeff Keighley, who has been the person behind Judges Week, which is the Game Critics Awards, which is a well-organized event that allows critics to get into LA a week before, get hands-on with games. And that is the rule, by the way. And this is something I think it's important to keep in mind. The rules on the Game Critics Awards where a game had to be playable. Now, that doesn't mean it had to be playable on the show floor, even behind closed doors for most people, but judges needed to be able to put a controller in their hands or sit down at a mouse and keyboard and manipulate the game to see that the game is, in fact, running and real.
So that we're not in the situation that we have been in the past where, oh, gee, the thing that we are seeing is not actually in an engine, or at least not playable.
Right, and that is why Cyberpunk in its first year was not eligible for a Game Critics Award, because
Correct.
It was not playable by the judges at all. So Jeff has started doing his own thing called the Summer Games Fest, and he had his big kickoff event. Was that last Tuesday? Wednesday? I don't know.
I believe it was last Wednesday.
Sure, I believe you, because...
I think. Maybe. Yeah. I don't even know. I don't know. Time is a flat circle and a social construct and also has no meaning.
Mm-hmm. So there were a couple very interesting things that happened around Jeff's kickoff. And the first one was, obviously, Jeff encouraged co-streaming. There were a number of events that Jeff co-streamed. But E3, when it came to start sharing some of the things that were going on, starting with the Ubisoft press conference, and this happened right before the Ubisoft press conference. E3 sent an email to a number of people, including Jeff, saying that, hey, if you didn't apply to be a co-streamer and you weren't accepted as a co-streamer, you are not allowed to co-stream the E3 channel. Now, thankfully, Ubisoft had its own channel, and I reached out to contacts at Ubisoft. Just to make sure. Yeah, and they were mystified by this statement. But that did mean, as you know, we held community nights for Capcom. Or community sessions for Capcom, and then we had to do it for Nintendo because Nintendo also said the same thing. So that was it. But there were also some things in there. If you want to, as we'll talk about the Capcom presentation and the Bandai Namco presentation, which was just about House of Ashes, which is the next Dark Pictures anthology game. It really felt like publishers were throwing E3 a bone because Capcom didn't really. They told us in advance what they were going to have, but it wasn't much new stuff.
No, it really wasn't. There was some stuff in there, obviously, that, you know, people could be like, oh, that's pretty cool. I like that. I enjoyed being able to see the new Ace Attorney stuff because I love Phoenix Wright and I love the Ace Attorney series. So I was like, oh, that's cool. I really enjoy that. But beyond that, there were some actual like there was too much filler from E3 official. And there was not enough actual substance like we're used to seeing from E3 and the news coming out of E3 proper. That's also partly because everything was very fractured and everything was very scattered.
Yeah, it was very, very strange. And then, of course, fast forwarding to the awards that happened last night, which, again, we just talked about how awards used to run where it had to be hands-on. And everything. The awards were all anticipation awards, and at the top of the show, they listed off the six outlets that were involved in choosing the awards. Those were IGN, GameSpot, GamesRadar, PC Gamer. Now, all of those are big outlets that you've heard of.
Of course.
IGN China and Game Bonfire, which to me is an interesting name because it reminds me of book burning. Were the other two. Now, you may not have heard of Game Bonfire, so I did a little poking around. They aren't on social media. I had to do some searching on the internet, and what I found out was that they are owned and operated by Tencent. And then I also was informed that IGN China is operated by Tencent. So one third of the voting organization or voting entities for these awards are owned and or operated by Tencent, which of course has major game holdings. Now, I certainly don't want to suggest that Tencent put their finger on the scale.
I don't think that's necessarily the case here.
Right.
But
And
the optics
the
certainly
optics here
are
aren't,
bad.
yeah, the optics aren't great. And then what I found out today was that the person who I think he's the publisher of Screen Rant, there are five sites that operate underneath that.
Including
They
Game Rant.
inquired. Including Game Rant, they inquired with the ESA and were told, eh, maybe next year. And of course, there are tons of outlets that were missing. Eurogamer was missing, and Game Informer was missing, and I'm sure you can think of any number of sites that typically are involved in those Judges Week awards, those Game Critics awards, that weren't involved. One of the other things that was said at the top of the show was that only publishers who had more than one game were eligible for an award. By the way, these were all most anticipated awards. Obviously, nobody got
Yes.
their hands on things. And remember, when you go to E3 and towards the end of E3, you typically see developers and publishers posting pictures of their walls of awards because each
Yes.
outlet does their own awards too. That certainly isn't happening.
No, it's not. And that's actually one of the most interesting parts of the wrap up of E3 in physical form is going around and taking a look at where other m members of the media, other journalists, other critics, other, you know, even influencers are really like putting their stamp of approval about, I'm really excited about this game. This is really hot. I'm really seeing a great future for this. It's difficult to be able to distill that in digital form. And instead, all we have is Twitter.
Right. Now, that's not to say that something couldn't be done. We know that for the past year, Parsec is a great tool that publishers have
Certainly.
used to get developer or get media hands-on time with their upcoming games. It's a controller sharing. It's a share play type technology.
It's pretty cool.
So there was something that could have been arranged and could have been done, but it wasn't. So there was this weirdness around E3, the official brand. So when we talk about E3 being a state of mind, it's important to recognize that while this week might have been E3,
E3.
some of the best stuff that came out of there wasn't even affiliated with E3, the brand.
Nope, and we will get there. So, Mike, why don't we start diving into some of the bigger overarching trends that we saw throughout the summer game mess, the beginning of the summer game mess?
Sure, and if you were with us during our live analysis and commentary, you probably heard us say a number of these things over and over and over again. So one of the things was, in addition to new game announcements, we were going to see big updates for big games.
Absolutely. And part of the reason why we saw more of these updates for the games is yes, these games are still very popular, but also because it's a bigger lift for less de like for fewer development hours in theory. And they would be able to deliver more impact for existing players, existing fans, their existing install base. And they wouldn't have to necessarily, fight through user acquisition or trying to convince people to purchase the game or even trying to unite their development teams to create something brand new while working under quarantine.
So yeah, so let's talk about some of the updates for big games that happened and some surprises in there. Some new decisions from big publishers. But Among Us, you've played some of those mods that you saw
I
in the
have.
trailer.
Yeah, absolutely. In the streams, the co-streams that I've done with Mermaid Royal, otherwise known as Jude, we have played with the Sheriff mod, which is very popular. And it is also something that you up until Among Us actually announced, InnerSloth announced that they are actually integrating the Sheriff role into the official game. That was just something you had to download on Git. On GitHub and, like mess around with your install and have a separate install so that you could play it. The really great thing about this, and this is something that I actually saw Victoria Tran, who heads up communications and marketing over at InnerSloth, was saying that working with mods was something that was really, really, really important to InnerSloth because there are people that are already doing great work on the game. Why would they rip that away from them and not give them the credit that they deserve, that they so richly deserve for creating something that so many people love, right? The Sheriff mode is so much fun, and I can't actually imagine playing Among Us on my computer without the Sheriff role. Because it is just too funny to have somebody show up and you don't know who the sheriff is, you don't know who the imposter is. The sheriff shoots the imposter or shoots somebody else and ends up dead. It's just an absolute maddening mess, but it's very fun.
Absolutely.
So it is wonderful that they are not just wrapping in popular mods, that they are giving them proper credit. Mods are super important for the community. It creates engagement. And remember, as Mike and I have talked about many, many times, engagement is the thing that developers and publishers really do care about just as much as their sales figures.
Absolutely. So running through some of the other ones, Rocket League, of course, getting Fast and Furious, tie-in vehicles,
Looks
which
ridiculous.
looks
I'm totally
cool.
going to play it.
Yeah, absolutely. Escape from Tarkov getting some new content. Fall Guys. Here's one that we didn't call out, but it's one that we've seen as a thread, not just during the Summer Games Fest, but throughout gaming over the past couple of years. So Fall Guys is getting that Nier Automata crossover. And of course, Fall Guys has had a lot of crossover skins for the beans. And Fortnite has obviously done a lot of crossover. We're seeing a lot of cross-pollination from game to game, but also pulling from outside, like Rocket League has, pulling in Fast and the Furious from film. We're not going to talk about the Fast and Furious game that came out, though. That
No, we
was
sure are not.
that wasn't
No,
great, unfortunately.
that's somewhat of a disaster, which is unfortunate as two people that actually really enjoy Fast and the Furious. So another really interesting thing that came up is Assassin's Creed Valhalla, right? It came out last year around the like I think believe it was at launch for the Xbox.
Yes, it came out at launch with the new consoles.
It came out at launch for the new consoles. And instead of rushing to get another Assassin's Creed out, and remember, as we've heard from Ubisoft, they are moving away from creating that iterative, that every single year iteration on existing franchises and giving themselves more room to breathe by creating a second year of updates for a game that's already doing quite well, both critically and quite frankly among players. It really does free up the team to figure out where they want to go next with Assassin's Creed. And obviously they are separate teams in a lot of ways because remember Ubisoft has thousands of people across a bajillion different studios. So But AC Valhalla getting a second year of updates, like, this is unprecedented for Ubisoft. They've never done something like this for an Assassin's Creed game. They have had the season passes and stuff like that, but that's usually only 1 year. They don't normally do more than 1 year. If they did for Odyssey, and I'm forgetting, please feel free to correct me, but
No, they did
I
not go
don't
beyond
think that they
the
did.
they
They
didn't
did
go beyond
1 year.
the season pass. Yeah, it was 1 year. So yeah, the second year is huge. And then of course Rainbow Six Siege is continuing to get support. There was that animated short for the new operator. Watch Dogs Legion, we knew that Aiden Pierce was coming back. Obviously, not my favorite character,
It's not
Marcus.
Marcus. Not Marcus, sorry.
But Ren and Wrench coming back from Watch
Wrench
Dogs
is
2.
cool.
But the fact that the two of them are going to be in the same expansion is very interesting. And then
Wrench
we've
is
got
likable. Aiden is unlikable.
Valorant, we got a very, very quick glimpse at the new character for that.
It was like
And
5 seconds.
then
They did warn us before we went into it that it was going to be exceptionally brief.
And then of course Apex continuing to get really excellent support. And we talked about how they support their community in the last show where there are, in fact, it's they're in week three of those loading screen drops right now with a different set of creators. So we saw this throughout all of these updates for big games that are coming. And even if you if we jump ahead to Nintendo, which I don't know if we're going to talk about too much here,
Probably not.
because
We did a whole show on that yesterday.
But even there, like Doom Eternal getting DLC, that dropped yesterday. We knew it was coming, but of course, supporting those games. The other thing, the other big trend in terms of gameplay style that we're seeing, and we just have a short list here, but these are five games that that really drive the point home. But co-op and that Left 4 Dead style, you know, gather your friends, push through the hordes of monsters, and get to the objective. What and of course there's different along the way, and Strange Brigade's not on this list, but that's coming to Switch as well, and we just finished playing that for game night, so that's fun. But there are five games that we saw this week that I that off the top of our heads that are in that play style.
Exactly. So we saw Rainbow Six Extraction, which was formerly known as Quarantine, which is going to be that very interesting co-op style stealth kind of game. It's a stealth action hybrid experience where, you're gathering your buddies and you got to go out into the world. And everything is really gross and weird and gooey. As things often get with aliens. Why are they always so gooey?
So gooey. Back 4 Blood, which is probably the purest expression of the original Left 4 Dead style gameplay, because it's made by Turtle Rock, which made the
Yeah,
original Left 4 Dead.
absolutely.
Of course, Back 4 Blood, while it does a lot of things that are very similar to Left 4 Dead, it has this card mechanic and a character mechanic where it's not just pick the character that looks that you like the looks of and everybody's the same. No, the character you pick matters. The decks you build matter because in between rounds you're drawing new cards. So you're really tuning and tailoring your play style in addition to just fighting through the hordes of Ridden is what they're called in Back 4 Blood.
Absolutely. I want to actually skip down to Redfall. You can
Of
talk
course you do.
about.
I'll talk about Contraband.
Listen.
I would not
Listen.
take Redfall from you. I would not take this from you.
Listen. If we want to talk about the game that really did steal a lot of people's attention, even just from a mood perspective, we did not see any gameplay. We don't actually know what this game is fully about yet. And we become very careful about getting too hyped up based on concept. I don't know how many times that's happened to me over
Oh,
the years
yeah.
since I was, just a wee thing watching E3 as like an 11-year-old child. But Redfall had such an amazing vibe that that is absolutely built around the whole Left 4 Dead shooting monsters and, having really like gorgeous, iconic designs, especially for black women and black femme presenting people. Like, oh my goodness, Layla. Like, hello. And yes, it is
Yes.
Arcane. So, Arcane really did bring the heat with Redfall. We don't know what the hell it's about. Honestly, at this point, what I really care about is I want to see what the gameplay looks like, and I want to make sure that I'm kind of tempering my own reactions. you know, outside of my own head, where I'm just kind of like running around in a circle in my head going, "Wee, it might be amazing." But it has vampires as monsters, and you don't see that very often in, especially in games where vampires are often just very sexy, you know, they're very appealing monsters. These are ugly, ugly monsters. So yeah, I am interested to see where Redfall is going to go.
Yeah, me too. It was definitely one of my if we're gonna just as a fan most anticipated. Yeah, Redfall's up there.
Yeah.
So Contraband we didn't learn a lot about during the Xbox showcase, but that's also coming to Game Pass. It's actually a heist game. It's a co-op heist game, and that's this twist on the Left 4 Dead kind of gather your team, go in, do the thing, get out. So Contraband's on the list. And then the last one's the Anacrusis. Chet Falzek, who was at Valve, that's his team, Stray Bombay. And it is a four-person in space on a spaceship, you know, again, in that same co-op Left 4 Dead style. So really interesting there.
It looks interesting. They're calling it a game that is infinitely replayable. So I'm interested to see it. I think it's got a really gorgeous aesthetic with that very like late 60s, early 70s look. So, which is kind of in line with what's going on with Loki, the television show right now. So apparently that aesthetic is having a moment. Who knew?
Good point. And then our next category, you know, vampires just in general starting to have a moment the way we had zombies.
Yes.
You know, have a moment. Vampires are back, baby.
I love this. I mean, not even just because I'm a huge World of Darkness fan, but I really like that Vampire the Masquerade is finally having a moment beyond people just being hungry for the next Bloodlines game or going back and playing Bloodlines or... goodness gracious, there was one before Bloodlines that came out that...
Oh, I know which one you're talking about.
It had this... Yeah, it had another... It was Christoph and Wilhelm.
I'm looking right now. It was...
And I don't bloody well remember what it's called. So anyway, my point is that it's been a long time. It's been a long time since vampires have had...
Redemption,
that was the one. That was the one. Vampire the Masquerade, yeah. Redemption. And
that came out
21 years ago. So between Redemption and Bloodlines, that's basically it. That's all we've had. And now we have more games like Swan Song, which is going to be a departure from what we have been seeing out of Vampire the Masquerade, which has either been Bloodlines or the move into visual novels. So Shadows of New York and... Night Hunt and a couple of, I think there's one other one in there that I also own, but I haven't played yet. So, and then there's Blood Hunt. Blood Hunt is a bit weird. It's a bit weird in the sense that multiplayer vampires in a game where you have to go around and just be like murder monsters, you're just, you know...
You're just breaking the masquerade.
The masquerade doesn't even matter at that point, and I feel like I could probably suspend my internal challenges with that if the gameplay is good enough. But Blood Hunt, you have some convincing to do.
I'm going to take us on a very short tangent. It seems like Paradox is approaching World of Darkness similarly to how Games Workshop has approached Warhammer.
I mean,
where they are kind of throwing a lot of, they're licensing it out very liberally and seeing what sticks.
Yes. And they're not just doing this. And again, this is a story that I have written for GamesBeat. They're not just doing this with video games. They're doing this all over the place within transmedia. So they're trying things out with comics. They're going to be trying things out with video. They're going to be trying more things out with tabletop and with board games, like with Vampire the Masquerade Rivals. So it is very scattershot. It is kind of the Games Workshop approach, but the Games Workshop approach also didn't start really spinning up into utter banana pants levels until relatively recently, where there are just hundreds of, like 100 plus games out there in development right now that have the Games Workshop license on top of it, but we know the ones that we trust. So now it's a matter of trying to figure out, okay, World of Darkness, what do we trust? which studios
Absolutely.
are going to handle the lore, the gameplay, and be faithful while still doing interesting things for players. Which studios really have this like nailed down, much mm-hmm. like they have with Warhammer.
Right. And then, so going back to the vampires, obviously Redfall falls into that category. There's a new Blood Rain game coming. There were a number of indie games that seemed to, there was Bats. Remember that indie game?
Mm-hmm.
So that's another one that seems to be like vampires and creatures of the night. So I think we're gonna start seeing this a little bit more. Obviously, zombies never went anywhere. We had a lot of zombies, and now we just have there are zombie games. I think we're on the upswing. We're gonna be seeing a lot more vampire games. I think it's more interesting. Lord knows we all became vampires in 2020 because we were stuck inside. So maybe we just want to kill that version of ourselves. Exactly.
That's so deep.
It's metaphor, baby.
That's so deep. You know what's not a metaphor, though?
What?
Jeff Keighley showing us that we probably don't need E3 anymore.
Mm-hmm. But that we do benefit from having someone who is a competent organizer, a competent maestro
yeah.
of all of these disparate events.
Yeah.
And someone who can pull it all together because... Yeah, the ESA just didn't. They had 15 months to stick the landing, and they just didn't do it.
Nope. They showed and there's a lot of politicking around that obviously Mike mm-hmm. and I are not necessarily privy to, but it is important to make note of, regardless.
Absolutely. So one of the things that this was really cool though, like Jeff started, he partnered up with a bunch of developers and with Steam to do the Summer Game Festival last year.
Sure.
Bringing E3, and this is going to be part of our conversation and kind of a beat that reiterates through, not just at this time of year, but throughout the year, and definitely into next year once physical events. You know, the advantage of going to E3 is being on the show floor and networking, yes, but getting your hands on games. What Jeff did starting last year... and Next Fest is live today, so the Steam demos, there are a ton of new Steam demos that just hit.
We're getting there, because demos yeah. are another big portion of this that we need to see more of going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. But being able to share that experience with literally anybody at home, not just, remember, there was a time where it was like, oh, you could go into a Best Buy and play a couple of these demos, or you could go into a GameStop and play mm-hmm. a couple of these demos. Now it's sit at home, and then it was sit at home, download them to your PC. Well, what if I don't have a PC? This year... And this isn't the first time. Xbox has gotten in on it, and they have a huge section of their store which is dedicated
yep.
to demos. In fact, last night, we were wrapping up work late, and Amanda's like, I'm turning my Xbox on, and I'm going to download some demos that I'm going to stream this week.
I have so many demos to play, both on my computer. I kind of want to just, like, stream until 7 o'clock tomorrow. We'll see. Or on Friday, rather, not tomorrow. Tomorrow yeah. is it's a hellscape of a day, so not
yes.
so much there.
Yeah, and I'm going to be streaming demos on Friday, so that's going to be a lot of fun. But demos, so that's one piece that kind of has started this whole snowball of Jeff really separating himself from the ESA and
yeah.
E3 as an event and making this his own. So one of the things that's super cool is that Jeff managed to get a new developer and a new publisher
right?
on his stage for the kickoff and announce. Like, those are two huge business beats.
Yeah.
And that is the kind of thing you expect from an E3. Absolutely. Big business beats.
But it is usually something that happens behind closed doors. These are conversations that you have with executives, with people that are in charge, and they end up in the media in different ways. Now, this was very public. This was
yeah.
front and center, which is something that we don't see much of out of the ESA, and certainly out of E3.
Yes. So the first one, of course, was Prime Matter. We have Stand Opal in our streams.
This is, in fact, an Opal Stand chat forever.
So Opal was the host of the Prime Matter press conference. That was announced with a sizzle reel at the kickoff event that Jeff hosted. The sizzle reel looked good. There were games in there
yeah.
that looked fantastic. And what we learned is that it's pulling from different pieces of the Embracer Group business units. It's not just
yes.
under one of them.
It's under a number of them.
Mm-hmm. So that means it's a premium label. So Payday 3, which is the partnership between Starbreeze and Koch Media, is going to be there. Saber Interactive, which is its own business unit, is working on a new painkiller game, and Todd Holland's head is involved in that. Blackbird Interactive is working on an RTS in the Crossfire universe, so that's a partnership with Smilegate.
That's super cool.
So there are these. There are 12 of these games. In fact, I just got a press release today about a new Prime Matter game that was signed. So it's absolutely wild. So Prime Matter signs physical publishing agreement with Tail Worlds Entertainment. So that's Mountain Blade 2.
Oh, that's right. Yes, Mountain Blade 2. That was another feature during the PC Gaming Show.
Mm-hmm.
Which actually looks really interesting if you like the Mountain Blade games, which I have in the past. Yes. So overall, the presentation itself was really weak. And it wasn't weak because Opal wasn't amazing, because Opal was charming and sweet and smart and funny and confident and just lovely. And it's not to say that the folks that she was interviewing weren't interesting either, because they were. They all had really interesting things to say. But this was deeply, deeply out of place for a consumer-facing show. Now, if this is something that had aired during GDC, this is something that would have been absolutely amazing during GDC. I would have learned, you know, it would have been in front of the right people. It would have been in front of analysts, developers, writers, journalists. It would have been more industry focused in terms of the people that would have been more receptive to those kinds of conversations. And unfortunately, what we ended up getting was a dry presentation for something that needed to be absolutely super exciting.
Mm-hmm. And it was too long, even for GDC.
It was.
So 2 hours of that was way too much. So I'm excited for the idea of Prime Matter, but and this is one of those things where you watch that and you're like, well, how did this happen? I am sure there were voices inside of Embracer Group saying,
oh, I imagine.
Do not do this. You need to fix this. You need to edit this. You need
to
shorten it. Everything. Yeah.
Yeah.
2 hours later, indeed. 2 hours later. Yeah. Saltines when we wanted s'mores. Exactly.
100%. So like we said, the Prime Matters Coke Prime Timer, or whatever the heck they ended up calling it. It was interesting, kind of from a business perspective, it was interesting from a development perspective, but it was not what needed to happen during E3. It just wasn't the right fit.
Yes. The other big announcement, of course, we talked about the publisher, but there's also a developer that was announced on Jeff's stage during the kickoff event.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was Deviation Games, which is headed by Treyarch vets Dave Anthony and Jason Blundell. So they don't have a game announced yet, which is fine. It, you know, lots of studios start up and they're just like, we're making something, but we're not talking about it yet, because they could be just prototyping, and prototyping is exceptionally valid. They did share that they are going to be partnering with Sony. Deviation currently employs 100 people and is still growing.
What was interesting to me, and after we signed off from watching that, I noted that, so way back with Vince Zampella and Jason Ward, the founders of Infinity Ward, now gone. They created the Call of Duty franchise for Activision.
Yep.
Gone, right?
Yep.
Sledgehammer, Michael Condrey, and who is now at Hangar 13, I think? Or has he opened a new studio
No, he opened a new studio for Take Two, I believe, under the Private Division label.
Got it. And Glenn Schofield is doing the Callisto Protocol with the PUBG with
that's correct. Krafton. With Krafton. That's correct.
Yes. And now you have the Treyarch leads, Dave Anthony and Jason Blundell, who have departed. We have been talking about this upheaval inside of Activision Blizzard for a while. And this
several
is a
years
lot
in
of
fact.
This is a lot of institutional memory that's left. And we still don't know. By the way, we're nearing the end of June and we have no idea about a new Call of Duty this year. And that's rare. We typically know something. We know what the game is. We know, and typically it's somewhere between, you know, depending on the year, could be as early as E3 or as late as Gamescom is when we find out about multiplayer. Warzone is completely changing everything.
It is changing everything. But I think the other thing to keep in mind is that we are still seeing the ripple effects of working under quarantine, working at home under less than savory conditions, not having the technology necessary in order to do the things you need to do, having VPNs that crash all the time, potentially, and just not having access to the actual hardware necessary or the group conversations that are in person and are it's genuinely more engaging to have creative conversations in person. Like it
Yeah.
is, it's, you know, it's no secret that it is. It is. It hits different. So if we don't see anything from Call of Duty this year, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say that, would you say, let me ask your opinion, would you say that working under quarantine is the unseasoned meat of work?
Yes, 100%. It was
season your meat, folks. You can work from home, but working under quarantine stinks.
It really does, and it's completely different. We've talked about it a lot over the last year and a bit that people have been working under quarantine, and as the United States continues to open up bit by bit, little by little, you know, I do hope that we take some of the lessons that we've learned in creating collaborative remote environments and continue to have that as part of a hybrid work environment for many of these creative industries. But we will see.
Yeah. So let's talk about two standouts that were widely ignored by the ESA and E3 and should
yep.
have been given some of that love.
Oh, yeah.
And that is the Guerrilla Collective and the Wholesome Direct.
Absolutely. And as you all know and probably listen to us for this reason, we love indies. We love indies. We love to celebrate indies. I think that it was a huge miss on the ESA's part to just kind of like sideline them, not have them part of it at all, because they were more focused on money, on publishers, on internal politics, and on things that would elevate their own status in their own minds.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the Guerrilla Collective didn't need the ESA at all.
Yep.
They had an impressive roster of sponsors, not just like one or two sponsors, but like a dozen sponsors.
Yeah, it's more
a
than
a dozen
that, actually.
Plus.
I'm looking at this list right now. So their platinum sponsor was Xbox. Their silver sponsors were Good Shepherd, Humble Games, and Tiny Build.
Mm-hmm.
Their bronze sponsors were PlayStation, All In Games, and I think those are all the bronze. And then they had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17 supporting sponsors, including Razer, Kickstarter, Astro, Raw Fury, Thunderful, Acapora, Whitethorn.
All very good.
So they had a huge amount of support.
They did, because this is necessary. The Guerrilla Collective last year was a standout during not E3, right? During the Summer Game Mess part one.
Mm-hmm.
And we absolutely loved it. And we loved it this year too. And now following it up with the Wholesome Direct immediately after, which is also in association with the Guerrilla Collective, but just focusing on those nonviolent games. It was so interesting and it was wonderful, and my Steam wish list is a mess. Wish me luck. I'm going to spend so much money.
I wish list you luck.
Yeah, that's that's fair. So in terms of trends, just to kind of blitz of them, you know, we saw a lot of photo games, so games that do focus that are evocative of, you know, Pokemon Go and Fatal Frame and all that stuff, but like really, really wholesome and more concerned with the creativity aspect of things rather than, you know, just using your camera as like a substitute for a gun. We saw grandma games, and as anyone that knows me knows, I love mom stories, and grandma stories are mom stories. And I think that's wonderful. I think that having more of an emphasis on moving away from only focusing on, you know, the coming of age tales that we see for adolescents and for children and or even like young adults, you know, moving more into, you know, adults that are over the age of 50, over the age of 60. I think that that's really compelling. And just the overall mainstreaming of cozy games, games that celebrate relaxation in games and that celebrate a beautiful pastel vibrant aesthetic that allow you to do things like go skateboarding and meet friends, that allow you to go fishing, that allow you to build up little civilizations, that allow you to tell really interesting, compelling stories that don't have to be about violence. It's not to say that there can't be dark, scary, you know, really like distressing things that happen in these quote unquote wholesome games, but it's not centered around violence.
Yeah, it's great. And as we talked about at the at the beginning. I mean, first of all, EA Originals, right, is one program. ID at Xbox is another. We're seeing big publishers participate in the indie game side of things, which is wonderful.
And being able to have access to these demos both on PC and on console is super important. I never forget to talk about Skatebird. Skatebird is super important because it's a game about literally about trying your best. It's literally about trying your best. So we do need to start like blitzing through some of these other things that we saw. Obviously, we need to get through Ubisoft's conference, Microsoft and Xbox and Bethesda, and wrapping things up. So Mike, why don't you take us through what happened during Ubisoft?
Sure. Ubisoft, I thought, was a relatively well-paced presentation. It had a good mix of genres. It started with Rainbow Six Extraction, which is your typical shooty bang bang game with,
it's
with gooey
so
aliens.
So gooey.
And then it took us through Riders Republic was one.
Oh, that
and then there was
cool.
There was another game that didn't involve shooting at all as well. So it helped kind of pace things out a little bit and remind us that, Just Dance was the other one.
That's right. Yeah. Oh my goodness. Just Dance for this year.
Oh,
and
Rocksmith.
You know, those were all really interesting because it was like, oh, we're going from watching cozy indie games and now we're going to go watch more cozy games, but from a AAA publisher. Oh, I like this.
You know, obviously, watching the Ubisoft Forward presentation left some questions. And one of those questions is Beyond Good and Evil 2. Michel Ancel has left Ubisoft. Is that game even still a thing? Based on what we're hearing, and again, this is anecdotally from people who have talked to people, that game was exceptionally ambitious and even overscoped. So it's going to be hard to pull that together, with especially without Ancel, and make a go of it. The other thing that popped out of Ubisoft was it's just a reminder that there is so much work left to do on the DEI side of things. And this is someone by the name of Lori O on Twitter, who is part of the Assassin's Creed Sisterhood Initiative.
I believe said, that Lori heads up, in fact, the AC Sisterhood Initiative.
Oh, okay. Well, there we go. Here's what she said. UB Forward had 12 devs present, of which only two were women. There were zero black women presenting and only one woman of color, our very own Callie Rickle, on the Assassin's Creed brand. Where is the progress? And to anyone wondering why I'm using this as a measure, usually devs in leadership are tapped to speak at these events. It's a visual reminder
Correct.
Of who is advancing in the company.
Absolutely. They have such a long way to go. And we know that. And I know that the folks at Ubisoft know that. It is, however, super important to recognize that while the higher ups continue to just step in it over and over again, it is okay to continue to support the developers, to continue to support the creatives and the staff working tirelessly on these titles and just genuinely to make people happy, you know? So I think that that's an important thing too, is that we can hold companies and cultures accountable while still enjoying their games and supporting the developers as much as we can.
And I think we know they have 20,000 employees right now.
That's so many people.
It's so many
it's
people.
The biggest 800-pound gorilla.
Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy. All right, let's talk about Xbox, which
yes!
you and I are in agreement.
Bethesda.
This was Microsoft's best presentation in years. It was
I
well-paced.
Think potentially
it had lots
ever.
Of stuff.
I think honestly, potentially ever, in all the years that I have been watching E3, and I've been watching E3 since 1998,
yeah.
I've never seen Xbox, and obviously Xbox didn't exist in the late 90s, didn't exist until the early aughts. But this was the most compelling, incredible, well-rounded, well-paced presentation that Xbox has ever had at E3.
Now, what was interesting, they started with Starfield, and remember Bethesda had gotten to the point where it had narrowed its announcement windows to 6 to 9 months. And saying that Starfield's coming in November, so 11/11/22, which is exactly 11 years after Skyrim came out on 11/11/11. Very interesting, but that is a way out. So this is a shift back, and again, this is all working under quarantine related. Now, they didn't start with their Xbox Bethesda presentation. There were a series of interviews and announcements that came out of the Xbox team in the days leading up to the Summer Game Mess. And in those, they committed to a new first-party Game Pass game every quarter. They expanded on that, of course,
yes.
In their presentation. They showed 31 games, 28 of which are coming to Game Pass on day one. So that's pretty huge. I mean,
it's enormous.
Game Pass is the best value in gaming. You and I have said it multiple times, and I stand by it.
I absolutely stand by it. I think that there's a lot of good to say about Xbox Game Pass, not just for consumers and players, but also for developers. You know, and we've talked about the successes that we've heard anecdotally from other developers, including Mike Rose, who runs mm-hmm. No More Robots and has talked extensively about how great Xbox Game Pass has been for the Descenders. So in addition to that, though, talking about ID at Xbox, right? We love indies. Xbox loves indies. ID at Xbox has brought in $2 billion for developers, since its inception in 2013. And
that's huge.
2,000 games have been launched through that program. I have seen some of the most innovative and interesting games on Xbox through the ID at Xbox events, because normally they hold actual, like, hands-on press events for folks in the industry that allow us to interact with some of the new or upcoming games that can be expected on ID at Xbox, like The Wild at Heart. That was one of the mm-hmm. ones that I really enjoyed a couple years ago when I went to the last ID at Xbox event.
So let's talk about Game Pass a little bit more, because Game Pass has been really good for developers because they negotiate a payout for them. Now, we know that Phil Spencer has said there's no one-size-fits-all deal.
Correct.
For some of them, I'm sure it's fully upfront. For others, it's partially upfront and partially based on downloads, perhaps.
Everything is different for everybody. Mm-hmm. You know, there is no one deal that's going to work for every single kind of indie developer. Because remember, indies, there are so many different kinds of indies. There are small, very, like, there's micro indie studios that's just one or two people. And there are really large indie studios where we're looking at between 50 and 100 people working on a game. So you can still be indie and be big.
Yeah. And of course, a day one Game Pass deal versus the game's been out for 2 or 3 years and it's coming to Game Pass, those deals are going to look very different. But the Game Pass arc has been acquisition so far. And we've talked about that. It's been acquiring core players to start with. But we know from what Microsoft put out last week that they're going to start working with TV manufacturers to integrate Game Pass into smart TVs. For instance, on our Samsung smart TVs, we have a Steam Link app. So we can access our computers and play our Steam games right on our TVs. I imagine a Game Pass option, an app right in there, is going to be great. The other option, and we know they're working on this too, is a streaming device. So it's like a Fire TV or a Chromecast or something that's a small mm-hmm. dongle or a small device that plugs in via HDMI and can stream Game Pass from it as well. They hinted that there were more Game Pass tiers coming, so less expensive monthly options.
I like that
a lot.
That's
good.
I like that a lot. I think that there is a lot to say about Xbox Game Pass creating a level of inclusivity and diversity among not just developers and games, but for players as well. Players that don't have, you know, $70, $60, $70 to shell out for the new releases that are coming to Xbox from first party studios, they can get in on that for, you know, a relatively small monthly price, but it is still expensive depending on, you know, how much money you're making or how the pandemic has affected you personally.
Mm-hmm. And additionally, on the affordable and accessible side, how they're handling Halo's multiplayer, the fact that multiplayer is free to play, you can buy battle passes at any time, those battle passes never expire.
They're infinite battle passes.
Infinite battle passes.
That's incredible. And I mean, if we want to dig into this for just a hot second, this is a move away from the whole scarcity marketing perspective that we've seen around battle passes in the past. I mean, we've seen it with Fortnite, we've seen it with Smite, we've seen it with, you know, to a lesser extent, Rocket League. But we have seen a lot of that where it's just like, if you don't get in on this now, then, you know, you can expect that you are not going to get this ever. Well,
yes.
All right, that's not how Halo Infinite is going to be handling things. Instead, you know, it's not trying to, yeah, following the Avengers style battle pass. I actually think that that is a really good analog. So
absolutely,
that's a unique selling proposition. That is what helps set Halo Infinite's multiplayer, which is going to be free to play, and it's going to have a similar model to how Call of Duty's premium titles and Call of Duty Warzone kind of just like feed into one another, right? They're different silos, but they essentially feed into one another. If you love Warzone, you know, maybe you'll move into the premium model. If you love the premium model, it's likely that you're gonna want to go play multiplayer with your buddies. So I just really like it. I like it because it's more inclusive and it's less like frightening.
Yeah. So let's run through the rest of the stuff. Microsoft is also going to be talking with telecom providers to do things like Xbox All Access. Again, pairing that
yes.
with your internet to get Xboxes and Game Pass into your house. Additionally, one thing that was kind of buried in there and The Verge surfaced it today or yesterday is that you're also going to be able to, just like with the PS5 and the PS4, stream your Xbox Series games over the cloud to Xbox to the Xbox One.
Absolutely.
Which is very, very neat. So if you want to play Flight Simulator and you don't have an Xbox Series device, you can still purchase Flight Simulator and then play over the cloud
to your
Xbox One. I don't know. I think that's coming at some point in the future. I don't think that's available right now. But if you can't get an Xbox Series, you still want to play those games, you can do it. And we know that they're improving their data center so that cloud is going to provide a similar experience to playing on an Xbox Series S or an Xbox Series X.
Absolutely.
Sorry, I said Xbox Series S. It's the extra small.
It's actually the extra small.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is in fact the extra small. Mike, is there anything else that you want to talk about with regards to Bethesbox?
Yes, I know we're running short, so we'll go really quickly. They're going to be doing a cloud-based try before you download thing on Xbox as well. So that's going to be really, really cool. Yeah, we talked about some integrations that are happening. In Flight Sim, you got the Top Gun crossover. In Sea of Thieves, you've got the Pirates of the Caribbean crossover. So again, reinforcing that transmedia, that cross-promotion type of thing that we've talked about.
And that Disney is very good at licensing and very bad at video
so
games.
Good. Yes. Yes. You know, there was some buzz about Phil Spencer noting that Xbox is the only platform shipping games on console, PC, and cloud simultaneously. People are like, oh, he took a shot at Sony. No. This is about promoting your brands, your products,
USP.
Your services, USP, your unique selling proposition. Lots of exclusives, which is the place where people have dinged Microsoft for years. So that's really good. We've got an answer now on how, at least partially, how Bethesda is going to be handling things now that they're owned by Microsoft. Their new games, their new IP, Starfield, Redfall, are going to be exclusives. Their
yep.
existing games like Elder Scrolls Online are going to continue to be cross-platform. They are honoring, as we've talked about, their commitments to Sony for Deathloop and for Ghostwire Tokyo. So that's great. And we already talked about Halo Infinite and the smart ways that they're approaching it. But we have one more thing before we wrap up for the day. And that is, hey, Sony might not have been present this week, but they did have very early on, our very first stream actually, was the Horizon Forbidden West. And
yes.
they also did some interviews this week. Axios got some time with Jim Ryan.
Absolutely. So what Jim Ryan ended up discussing was a handful of things, including the challenge of getting PlayStation 5s into players' hands. He basically just outright said that he is really frustrated at resellers and bots getting their hands on the hardware stock before players are able to. And this company has been somewhat successful in circumventing this because they're still going they still have their direct sales on their website. And remember that Sony has been moving more and more and more towards that. That's part of the reason why we are seeing that scarcity around the PlayStation 4 DualShock controllers, because they do want people purchasing directly from them.
Yeah. Now, of course, retailers are not thrilled about this, but at the same time, if they had better bot protection in place, you know, Sony might not feel quite as compelled to spend more of its energy expanding its direct sales.
Absolutely.
So that's really interesting. Axios' Stephen Totillo asked Jim Ryan about that famous quote about backwards compatibility and why would anybody ever want to play old games. And, Ryan said, well, the point that he was trying to make was that about how good the PS4, this was a comment that was made during the PS4 era, specifically about Gran Turismo. Why would anybody want to play an old Gran Turismo game if the PS4 looks so good?
Mm-hmm.
I don't necessarily believe that. He had to eat a little crow because the head of Gran Turismo, obviously they love showing those history videos and the evolution of that franchise. And, you know, it seemed like this was a double back. This was a retreat from that statement for Jim Ryan. He also pointed to Astro's Playroom, which celebrates PlayStation's history as proof that he doesn't hate old games.
That's
I'm going
to
be honest with you.
Anything to do with Jim Ryan, though.
It doesn't. And quite frankly, including your history in a game like Astro's Playroom, which is all about, look at how great this new console is. It's a tech demo for all the cool things. By the way, I love Astro's Playroom.
That's great.
Including that doesn't say, that does, I don't
that
buy
doesn't,
it.
That doesn't hit the way you think it does, Jim Ryan. It really doesn't.
Which is pretty normal.
So the other thing that he ended up saying is that, you know, the PS4 support only came around. So PS4 support for...
On PS5.
On PS5 only came around because of fan desire. And he declined to comment on the PS1 support at all, even through PlayStation Now.
Yeah. We'll be talking about this on the news show. What he said about the Cyberpunk 2077 delisting, it was a tough decision for us to make, but ultimately we had to act in the interests of the PlayStation community. I'm going to stop the quote there because what we know is that it is coming back next week, and Sony has already issued a warning that it is still not going to play well on PlayStation 4.
On the base PlayStation 4, they actually do recommend PlayStation 4 Pro.
There were two pieces to that statement. The two pieces of the statement were, it's still going to have problems on on PlayStation 4. As the platform.
Oh, okay.
We recommend PS4 Pro
okay.
or PS5.
Okay, I guess I misinterpreted that. So, and as the last thing about this interview with Axios, we do know that they have been working with Deviation Games, which we just talked about with regards to the Summer Game Fest, for about a year. So that makes three external partnerships, including Jade Raymond's Haven Studio. Good for Jade for dusting herself off and just getting right back into it and doing what she does best after everything that happened with Stadia, and Firewalk Studios, which was formed by former Destiny devs.
Yep. So let's quickly wrap the show up by talking about, do we need the ESA and E3?
Okay. So I think that when we talk about E3 being a state of mind, it really is something that is it's special, right? If we think about times in our you know lives as journalists, E3 has almost always been that very special time of year where we get to get in and talk to developers and talk to AAA executives, you know, really suss out some of the biggest and interesting trends. But as we have also proven by doing this remotely, do we?
I don't think so. E3 is a marketing vehicle, and that's how it sells the show to publishers. We know that even today, it sells it as a marketing vehicle as if their brand has some great cachet.
And it did.
It did, but it has squandered that.
It did for a long time, and it has absolutely squandered that. And something else to remember is that E3 was a trade show for a very long time, and getting access to E3 was something that was very special. It was something that was, you know, reserved for folks that had been, you know, like I remember when I went to my first E3, that was, you know, 11 years ago. It was a completely different experience than E3 2019. Very different. And of course, events evolve. But yes, E3 used to be like gaming Christmas. And that actually brings us all the way back. E3 used to be a trade show. So when E3 happened, this was about business meetings. This was about prepping for the all-important holiday season and what was going to be launching and how the retailers were going to handle things and how publishing partners were going to handle things and what those partnerships were going to look like.
Yep. And the other thing is, you know, I feel like the ESA and E3 have tried to claim credit for things that it did not have a hand in. And at the same time, we know from the awards yesterday, didn't even acknowledge those things. So it's weird, like, oh, look at all these things that are happening, the Guerrilla Collective, Wholesome Direct, and they don't provide any marketing for that. They didn't even acknowledge those shows exist. And so, no, they don't really get a lot of credit for it. Look, I think that we do need and do benefit from a summer game festival. Now, whether that
is
Jeff or somebody else.
A festival that's around this time of year, because we do need to be inclusive to those folks that are not, you know, in the Northern Hemisphere.
Sure. The middle of the year
game festival. Yeah, the half year game festival. I think that that is really important. And I think it's important because it gets people excited. It brings people together. It gives us all something to talk about. We end up seeing what the rest of the year is going to look like. Right? Because we get to see some of that in the beginning of the year, because we have, you know, this sporadic directs and states of play and everything like that towards the beginning of the year. But we don't have anything until about the middle of the year that says, okay, this is what the holiday season is going to look like. Plug in your hype machines, because we going.
So I think we need something. I do not think we need the ESA. The ESA is a lobbying agency. We know why it continues to do this. It's because of the $20 million it gets a year from this event. I don't think publishers benefit from having the ESA represent their interests, especially after they were fawning over Trump during the beginning of that administration. But I don't think there is anybody else who wants to step up and do the lobbying that the ESA does. So
I think that the ESA is still important from a lobbying and from a political cachet perspective. The ESRB still remains one of the most important things that the ESA has ever done. The ESRB is, you know, I've written over for the ESRB. I really like the people at the ESRB, including Pat Vance, who runs the organization. It is such an important piece of this industry that, especially in North America, that we need it. We need the ESRB.
Yep. We do. So my suggestion here is that the ESA get the heck out of front-facing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Focus on what you do. You want to lobby, you want to do the ESRB, great, fine. Get away from E3. Let somebody else handle it. Let some other organization that has that expertise, you let Jeff pull together those publishers and put an organization around him that can do this, because people like and respect Jeff. He's not perfect.
No.
But he knows how to execute on this.
But who is? Like, I mean, we've all stepped in it at one point in time or another, and it just happens that Jeff is a very public-facing figure. So always hold public-facing figures accountable, but also remember that we are all human. And there has been growth, because there was a greater focus on accessibility within the Summer Games Fest that wasn't there last year. And I would love to see Jeff do even more around accessibility and having more conversations about DEI and accessibility, because that is what E3 actually did do very well this year, was having those hard conversations about diversity, equality, and inclusivity that the Summer Game Fest didn't.
Yep.
Right. And so we, you know, credit where credit is due. And the other thing that that E3 did really well was it brought in like a wide range of diverse and interesting hosts. Right. I mean, like Greg was there. Jackie Jing is just a lovely human being. And Golden Boy is fabulous as well. So, you know,
and they also had the Take-Two panel on diversity, and they held a diversity conversation right before the award. So I want to acknowledge that it
credit
wasn't
where credit
all
is due.
Bad.
No, absolutely not. But the problem here is that it was too scattershot for it to feel like it was a cohesive and coherent event run by the ESA for E3. There were many people in the media that applied for media status that went to the ESA lobby, to their portal, like maybe once.
Well, and they declined a whole bunch of people who have been in the industry for years, and you know they weren't allowed to participate. It was wild. So we're going to go ahead and we're going to wrap up the podcast here. Thank you so much for listening to the Virtual Economy Podcast and joining us for our V3 coverage. You can follow us on Twitter at Virtual Econcast. I am at Footerish, FUTTERISH.
And I am at Amanda Farrow. You can subscribe to our RSS feed, which maybe potentially perhaps sometime in the future will also include more writing. Remember when we said we wanted to do more writing? Remember when we said that we weren't going to be super busy this year? Remember when we said all those things? Yeah, we were wrong. So, but
yeah,
Eventually we will have more writing. We're hoping that we get past the whole nonsense about, I'm hoping we get past that very, very soon. But anyway, so you can subscribe to us at virtualeconcast.com. You can also listen to us on all major podcasting platforms, including Spotify, iHeartRadio, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, Pocket Cast. I think there's one more.
Pocket Sand.
Oh, the Pocket Sand. It always gets me. And if possible, on your platform of choice, subscribe to us. You can subscribe here on Twitch. You can subscribe on any of the major podcasting platforms. And if possible, review the show. We always love to know what you think.
Yep. And if you have questions, you can DM us at podcast@fsquared.biz. You can also DM us on Twitter. We have Signal. So if you want to chat that way, we're glad to provide. We're glad to provide those numbers. We also have a Discord, which I am going to do the thing right there. Put that into the chat. Awesome. We have a Ko-fi, ko-fi.com/virtual economy.
And we will be back on Saturday with our weekly news show in podcast format, not live. So remember to wash your hands, stay hydrated, and be good to one another.